Whether it was klezmer music, novelty recordings, cantorial music, if it appealed to Jewish Americans in the 1950s and 60s, Tikva Records would release it if the price was right. Tikva was a low-budget label that got performers on their way up or their way down or their way to nowhere. A new anthology of Tikva Records has been produced by the Idelson Society for Musical Preservation, a group founded with the mission of collecting lost Jewish recordings and re-releasing or archiving them. The founders have been to more than their share of thrift shops and flea markets. My guest is one of the founders of the group, Josh Kuhn. He's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he directs the popular music project at the Norman Lear Center. The new Tikva anthology he co-produced is called Songs for the Jewish American Jet Set. Here's the opening track, Mazel, which is Yiddish for luck. It's sung by Leo Fuld.
Banana mazel, 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 babble the babble, have just a little mazel. That's the only thing you need, you gotta have a little mazel. Mazel means good luck, 'cause with a little mazel, you always make a buck. And if you have no mazel, although you're on the bowl, you try and try and can't get by, you beat your head against the wall. Don't ever try to figure why you seem to be to blame. That some folks have a million and can't even write their name. That's why you gotta have a little mazel. Mazel means good luck, 'cause with a little mazel, you always make a buck.
That's Leo Fuld singing Mazel from the new anthology Songs for the Jewish American Jet Set, the Tikva Record Story. Josh Kuhn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
So tell us about Leo Fuld, who we just heard.
Leo Fuld is considered to be one of the kind of greatest Yiddish superstars of the World War II era, and especially in the post-war years. And he was someone who, though best known for his Yiddish and English songs, most believe he sang somewhere around 15 different languages, kind of the ultimate polyglot pop star of that era. And this is him doing a really kind of swinging and jazzy English and Yiddish and Hebrew tune that he mixes up all these different languages in the, you know, in the songs that he would sing.
Now, one of the things I find amazing about the record that we just heard is that the R&B vocal group The Ravens recorded that song first.
And they did, yeah.
Do you know when they recorded it and why they recorded it?
I believe they recorded it around 1947. I believe it was the first recording of Mazel, actually. And so the first recording of Mazel, which was written by Artie Wayne and Max Beekman. This was a song that was, you know, with very much explicitly Jewish content, was recorded by one of the leading African-American R&B groups, you know, the post-World War II years. As to why they recorded it, there is one story that's been floating around for a while that basically the songwriters came into the recording session and kind of pushed the song on the group. But I also think it speaks to the extent to which there are so many Jewish songwriters writing for black artists and so many Jewish managers managing them that there was a kind of common ground where in-jokes in Yiddish, in-jokes about blacks and Jews, about Jews in America, were something that had become fairly common among so many blacks and Jews working in the pop music industry at that time.
Okay, so here's the Ravens recording of Mazel.
Well, you gotta have a little mazel, and you never will get stuck, 'cause with a little mazel, you always have good luck.
Well, you gotta have a little mazel, 'cause mazel means good luck, and with the little mazel, you'll never, never, never get stuck. Yes, you got to have a little mazel, 'cause mazel means good luck. And with the little mazel, you'll always have a fun. Don't ever try.
It's such an interesting comparison between the two, and really it's Leo Fuld who does it more of a novelty song, and the Ravens sing it pretty straight.
Yeah, that's not uncommon, actually. We found over the years in following the amount of black artists who would sing Jewish tunes that so often it was the African-American artists who would do the songs more straight, and it was the American Jewish artists who would kind of add a little bit of humor to them. So that back and forth is something that's been going on for a long, long time.
So let's get to the Tikva Records story. And the first recording we heard, the Leo Fold recording, was on Tikva Records. It's included on the new anthology you put together, mm-hmm. Songs for the Jewish American Jet Set. Now, you described the Tikva label roster as a who's who of who's that. And yes. The DJ Art Raymond, who played a lot of Yiddish music on his show and I think helped you find some Tikva recordings, he described the label's output as junky music. So why would you want to put it together an anthology of this label?
One man's junky music is another generation's joy. So I think that this label, which was the most prolific record label that catered to an American Jewish audience in the post-World War II years, that operated from the late 40s through the 1970s, it gives us this kind of window into understanding what Jews were buying, what Jewish identity could sound like in all of its mixture and diversity. And it was this crucial time in American Jewish life, and these post-World War II years, where you had record numbers of Jews moving up the economic ladder. Suburbanization was on the rise. Corner shuls were becoming big synagogues out in the suburbs. And Jews were caught in that push and pull between mainstream American white identity and the kind of old world identities of the pre-World War II years, balancing English and Yiddish and Hebrew. Hasidic populations were on the rise in the United States after World War II. And so there was all of these different identities. And what we loved was that you looked at Tikva Records and Alan B. Jacobs just said, well, I'm not going to try to choose one of these. I'm going to try to market and cater to all of them. So the entire catalog is this grab bag of identities and styles that speaks to all of these different changing political affiliations. Of course, the rise of, the birth of the State of Israel in 1948. So there's a lot of material on the roster that speaks to the kind of growing power of Israel in the American imagination. So it's all there.
We mentioned the birth of the State of Israel kind of coinciding with the birth of Tikva Records, and that leads to the next recording I want to play, and this is by Avram Grobart, who was Israeli. So tell us a little bit about who he was and about this recording that you featured on the new anthology.
So Avram began, I guess, as an Israeli paratrooper who ends up coming to the United States as an accordionist and as a singer, but also as a nightclub owner. He owned a fairly successful nightclub in Manhattan called El Avram. And it was called that not because he's Latino in any way, but because it used to be a flamenco bar owned by a Puerto Rican. And Avram couldn't afford to completely redo the marquee, so he left L up there, and he stuck his first name on the marquee, and it became a Jewish and Israeli nightclub. He called the music a Mediterranean bouillabaisse of sound.
The nightclub used to be called El Chico, and he turned
exactly,
it to El
sorry,
Avram.
Exactly right. And he still is with us, so much so that he has recreated the nightclub in the basement of his home in New Jersey. So if you go to Avram's house, knock on the door, he will take you downstairs, and he has meticulously recreated the nightclub in his basement.
So this is Avram Grobart, recorded in 1968, and it's included on the new anthology Songs for the Jewish American Jet Set, the Tikva Record Story.
Yambino sembol, rakhol vahol, yatsim mi de barde, no mi shehol. Yambino sembol, rakhol vahol, yatsim mi de barde, no mi shehol. Ufla, utzlil holde, yo katsub. Ma limposin, eno facu, ditandinedan.
So that's Avram Grobard from the new anthology, Songs for the Jewish American Jet Set, the Tikva Record Story. So tell us a little bit about the founder of the label, Alan Jacobs. He had owned other labels before starting Tikva. What was his plan in starting Tikva Records? You call this his biggest gamble. Why was it a gamble?
He was a gambler. He was really kind of a hustler and an entrepreneur, really trying to make his way in the record business. But it seemed clear to us, in the more that we talked to folks and spoke to the kids of many of the artists who are on the records, that, you know, he was somebody who saw this as a business opportunity, but really saw this as a chance to produce records inexpensively, to record them very quickly, to put the cover art together, in most cases himself with his trusty pair of scissors, and as most believe, cutting his masters together himself, often in some sloppy ways that you can hear on some of the records, in an attempt to cater to what he saw was a massive audience of American Jewish record buyers. You know, the result was this kind of grab bag of styles and sounds.
Did you get a sense that he really loved music or that he was just in it for the money?
It's a mix of both. I mean, there's clearly elements, I think, the more we looked at a lot of the stuff, and especially talking to a lot of the kids of the artists that, you know, saw him as someone who wanted to put stuff out quickly. And there is a rushed quality to a lot of the records. They sound real good on the anthology, but when you listen to a lot of the original vinyl, you can hear the edits on the vinyl. It's you know, you can hear where the tape comes together in a lot of ways. So he would rush through them, but it's clear he had to love the music. I mean, he spent you know, from the late 40s to the 70s collecting this stuff and putting it out, and you know, I doubt he was making a fortune off of it. So I think that the love had to be there, and I think that shows in the range of materials and in the joy that so much of the music has within it.
Now, the Idelson Society, which you're part of, which produced this new Tikva Records anthology, among other things, they're named after Abraham Zevi Idelson, the musicologist who wrote Hava Nagila. Now, when I read that, I thought, somebody wrote Hava Nagila? I thought that was like an old folk song by Anonymous.
Yeah, the melody is actually an ancient Hasidic tune. But the lyrics were written fairly recently in the 19-teens by Idelson and his students at the music school that he started in what is now Israel, but then was Palestine. And Idelson was the man responsible for giving us these lyrics that are, you know, has become the kind of great global Jewish anthem.
So what do the lyrics mean in English?
They are a command to be joyous and be happy and rejoice, rejoice, rejoice. One of the happiest songs ever written. You know, again, but I think what's also important for us about that tune is it's something that people think of as so Jewish. I mean, it's the ultimate Jewish song, and yet it's been covered by everyone. I mean, it's been covered at least in the U.S. something like 200 times, and it got famous in the United States, you know, by Harry Belafonte. And
I didn't know that.
I mean, when he performed that song live at Carnegie Hall in, I believe it was 1959, it pushed that song into the folk music world and kind of made it into a pop anthem, something that so many people have grown up with. That I think that's also what is kind of symbolic of the work that we're interested in, is this stuff that is, in a way, Jewish at its core, and yet it is also not Jewish in its routes and its travels. And we're kind of interested in following all of those pathways. And what's also, I should say, interesting about Idelson is he's someone that, as a musicologist, devoted much of his life to, you know, we often think of him as a Latvian Alan Lomax, that, you know, he would roam the Middle East and looking for songs that he could compile to say, this is Jewish music. He would do multi-volume encyclopedias of music as a way to try to define Jewish identity.
So as you pointed out, there are so many recordings of Hava Nagila, yet none of them are on your anthology Songs for the Jewish American set. Did Tikva not record Hava Nagila, or did it not record good versions of it?
There were some Hava Nagila versions, none of which were as outstanding as Hava Nagila should be. One of the projects we have in the near future is to do a compilation of only Hava Nagila versions. It's going to be about 20 different versions of Hava Nagila, which will either make you completely insane or will bring you nothing but endless joy.
Okay. So, you know, it's interesting. I think probably the majority of Jewish Americans who came of age in America while Tikva was releasing records, 1950 to 1973, are the progeny of Eastern European Jews. But the next recording I want to play from your anthology is by a Sephardic Jew, someone who was from Morocco.
Yes.
And this is an interesting recording, and he has an interesting personal story. So tell us a little bit about him before we hear the record.
Yes, this is the Moroccan prince, as he became known, you know, in the U.S., the great Joe Amar. And Joe Amar was born in Morocco, but ends up coming to Israel and within Israel becoming the main importer and popularizer of Sephardic melodies and so-called Eastern melodies. And he was instrumental in popularizing, you know, the musics of Morocco, of North Africa, of the Sephardic past, into a kind of hybridized pop and spiritual sound.
Well, Josh Kuhn, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Josh Kuhn is one of the producers of the new anthology, Songs for the Jewish American Jet Set, the Tikva Record Story, 1950 to 1973. We'll close with a recording by the singer we were just talking about, Joe Amar. It's called L'Oriental, and as you can guess by the title, it's sung in French. Et pourtant je ne fais pas de mal, on m'a surnommé l'Oriental. On critique ma vie. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.